Michael Tonsmeyer joins me from Sapwood Cellars to discuss high-gravity barrel-aged stouts. This is Beersmith Podcast number 302.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 302, and it's mid-April 2024. Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week from Sapwood Cellars to discuss high-gravity barrel-aged stouts. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They've recently launched an all-new experience, Craft Spirits and Distilling. If you make or love spirits, check out spiritsanddistilling.com for recipes, how-to videos, their Spirits and Distilling podcast, and much more. Again, that new site is spiritsanddistilling.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is the author of the book American Sour Beers, as well as author of the blog The Mad Fermentationist. Michael is also an award-winning brewer, certified beer judge, and founder of the brewery Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland. Michael, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's always great to get a chance to unwind after a long day at the brewery and talk about beer.
Yeah, it's been almost a year since we had you on last. How are things going at Sapwood Cellars right now?
Good. Probably a year ago, we were still in the long process of opening a kitchen, and we're still doing that currently. I think finally permitting is going to start coming through in the next couple of weeks, and we'll be able to start building
out. So you still don't have it open yet?
No, I haven't even started building it.
Oh, no.
Welcome to adding a restaurant. I mean, it's great that, I mean, the brewery itself is still doing fantastic, and yeah. We've got three great brewers under us, and we've actually just started offering our sour beers through Tavor for shipping. So if anybody's interested, we've got a shipping club for the sour beers that is going on right now. And if you can't make it to Columbia, that's one of your only other options to try our beers.
Oh, so you primarily just serve on premises, right?
Yeah, we send a little bit of beer out the door to local sort of bars and restaurants and things like that. But most of the barrel-aged stuff is just sort of local only. Either we have a local club or people just come in and buy bottles. Those beers, I think just barrel-aged sours in general, the people who love them really love them. But sadly, it's not the kind of thing that a lot of local liquor stores are that interested in. They want IPAs and they want stouts. But when it comes to barrel-aged mixed firm and gin barrels with peaches, that's just not something I think the average person's going into a liquor store and looking to stock up on for $20.
Bit of a specialty thing, I think, right?
For sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Did you have a club or membership where people could get access to some of those rarer bottles, perhaps?
Yeah, we've got a couple of clubs, and that's up till now. It's just been you have to come to the tasting room. You have to pick those bottles up once every 6 months or once every release or whatever. But it's nice to give people an option, particularly both my partner Scott and I have been, such longtime homebrewers and writing about beer and talking about beer, to give people in other parts of the country a chance to try those beers, ship to their door. And we're lucky Tavor does a lot of shipping stuff, and so they're coordinating the whole thing. It's like there's 30 states where they'll send it to. So if you either come to our website or whatever, then there'll be a link to it if you're so inclined.
Yeah. Sapwood Cellars, of course, right?
Yeah.
Well, today you want to talk about strong stouts and barrel-aged stouts, some of my favorite topics, actually. Can you tell us about these styles?
Sure. It's sort of funny. Scott and I really never brewed many stouts at home. I would do maybe one batch of stout a year or something like that. And when we opened, I think I probably famously said that, you know, sure, we'll maybe do a stout every winter or something like that, but we're not going to be one of those breweries that always has stouts available. They can just be so heavy and so rich. And that just, it didn't, you know, strike me as something that we would always want to have on draft. And then we brewed a couple and people said, hey, these are really fantastic. Could you do more of them? And as a business owner, when people buy your beer, they're voting with their wallets and we brewed more. And so it started out as just sort of something we did once in a while. We brew pretty big batches, usually like 20 barrels of stout, and sort of half of it will go into barrels for aging, and then half gets served fresh as is, maybe adjuncted with coconut or coffee or chocolate or vanilla. We do sort of, you know, the more classic stouts too. We do an Irish dry stout on nitrogen. We do, you know, we just did a Baltic porter, sort of other, you know, dark beers. But it really seems like what people are excited about these days is, you know, sort of the bigger, stickier, you know, roasty, but not super, super charred, hopefully sweet, but not, you know, too syrupy or anything like that beers. So, yeah, and that's, it's something that really has taken us some time to sort of dial in and figure out what works for us and the flavors that work for our palates and, the, you know, how to get those ridiculously high starting gravities on our system that was definitely not designed for that. So, yeah, we can dig into all those things tonight.
Well, what kind of stout do you brew? What would you call it in terms of a style? Is it sort of an imperial stout or something different? It's obviously not a plain English stout, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we do some sort of more, you know, oatmeal porter or whatever, but I'd say, you know, 80% of the stout we brew, I'd call it imperial stout. It's certainly towing the line once you get adjuncts into it into being a pastry stout. For me, though, I really believe that stout sort of needs some roast. Even when we're doing, again, you know, the sweeter adjuncts, you know, toasted walnuts, vanilla, coconut, those sorts of things. It's really valuable to have some roasted barley, some chocolate malt, some black patents, something in that kind of sharper, roastier kind of category to balance out the high final gravity, to balance out the sweeter adjuncts. Because in the end of the day, sort of every beer should be somewhat drinkable. And again, you know, at 10 or 11% imperial stout, the judge for drinkability probably isn't the same as it would be for a 4% Pilsner. You know, a drinkable 4% Pilsner, you should be able to drink two or three of. I'm happy if someone says, oh, I split a bottle of your imperial stout with my friend. We both finished our glasses and we wish there was more. You know, that's 8 ounces, something like that is about all you're going to, you know, sort of hope for. Particularly, I mean, I'd say sort of the driest we finish any of these beers is about 1050.
Wow.
And some of them go all the way up to like 1100. So, I mean, they are big and rich and thick and caramelly. And it's honestly, it's surprising to me. If you told me 10 years ago that we would finish stouts at 1050, 1060, 1070, I would have said that's outrageous. That must be just undrinkable. And it's funny now, you know, we'll have a beer that attenuates a little bit more than we expect down to 1040, 1045. And people will say like, hey, you know, oh, it's, this is a real dry one, man. This is really drinkable. And, you know, it could use a little bit more sweetness.
Wow.
And it's surprising how much I don't know if it's their palates have acclimated to it. I don't know if it's that we're adding, you know, again, you know, a decent amount of roast and a decent amount of hops to it. But really these beers, particularly once you get oak involved and spirit barrels and the tannins and all those things, they don't taste as sweet as you would expect them to. And that's something I'd sort of say to people is just like, don't be too hung up on the numbers, you know, let your palate be the guide. You know, don't be worried if a beer technically under attenuated that you only got 55% attenuation, taste it, drink it, and, you know, make a decision for yourself based on the palate, the flavor, the sweetness that you detect, because that's all a beer judge is going to get. That's all a customer's going to get. That's all really your friends are going to get. No one's going to say it tastes too sweet because it's at 1050. They're going to drink it and say either it tastes too sweet or it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty amazing. You're making them finish at 1050. You got to be starting at 1150 or so, right? Probably.
Yeah. You spot on. That's sort of 1135 to 11. 65 or 1170 is sort of the general range.
I've made meads that big. I've made meads in that range, and they finish in the 1040 range. But you balance those with a lot of tannic fruit, something like a black currant, for example. I assume you're using the roast to balance out the sweetness here.
Yeah, exactly. We do sort of a combination. Usually, I love like Weyermann Carafa Special 2. Is a great way to get sort of like a baseline roastiness without being sort of like really harsh or acrid. But then I almost always pair that with something a little more aggressive. So either and or some black patent malt, English roasted barley, chocolate malt that hasn't been dehusked or anything like that. One of those, a couple of those for... It doesn't have to be a huge amount, but when you're talking, you know, with these big grain bills, even 5% of the grain bill is actually quite a bit of those grains.
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things when you're adding that level of roast and you're making these super dark beers is pH. I think the times you get beers that are sharp or harsh or acrid, it's usually a combination of roast and a low pH. And again, you know, those darker grains will naturally lower the pH. So making sure that you're thinking about adding some baking soda, some chalk, some slaked lime even, something that's going to keep that pH up in the fives when you're boiling, when you're starting your fermentation, and then hopefully finishing in the sort of 4.5, 4.6 sort of pH range.
Yeah, I have the same problem with, I mentioned the big fruit meads. You've got to put, typically I use potassium bicarbonate, which will drive drive the pH back up during fermentation, because if you let it get too low, you let it get down to low threes, it starts actually inhibiting fermentation.
Yeah, no, not only the yeast's not going to be happy, but you know your palate's not going to be happy. And with a mead, you might be able to get away with lowering the pH later, you know, to make that fruit pop a little or anything like that. But with stouts, it really just leads to just to me, it either tastes like coffee or chocolate that's gone bad, something like that, or again, just sort of like burnt, harsh, acrid, and your pH is even going to be driven down further in a beer, because as you boil, particularly these really big, high gravity worts, that creates more Maillard reactions, more melanoidins, which again will drive your pH down even lower. So if you're doing like an extended boil, you may need to be dosing in baking soda or slaked lime or potassium carbonate as you go.
Mm-hmm. So how do you start at the hot side? Obviously you got to get how do you get to these really high gravities? First of all, cause you know, typically you're going to get very low efficiency, when you're trying to work with this much grain.
Sure. So we've gone through sort of a few different iterations. I'd say we have like a couple of different approaches. One approach is just get as much grain as you can, in your mash tun, run off as much as you can, and then add sugar. We certainly, almost all of our stouts get a couple of bags of malt extract. They might get some maltodextrin if we are worried that they're going to dry out too much. They might get maple syrup. They might get unrefined, Muscovado or brown sugar, something like that. And honestly, those are all, you're going to have enough malt flavor. If you're starting at 1/100 from malt, as long as you've got enough specialty malt in there, you can then go the rest of the way with sugar, and your beer is not going to taste thin. It's not going to taste overly watery or anything like that. So if you're comfortable doing a bunch of sugar, that's a great approach. What we tend to do is, if we're doing a beer that will be sort of split, some in a barrel, some onto adjuncts fresh, that's generally the approach we'll take. That said, then we will usually brew three or four times a year special batches. They're intended 100% for barrels. And for those, we'll do multiple mashes for a single boil. And wow, there's a couple of different ways we can go about that. So one maneuver is we will do a big mash on day one, run off as much as we can, fill up the kettle, start boiling it, set it on low, leave it boiling overnight. So we'll boil maybe 50% of the volume off. The next day we'll come in, do a small mash, run that off into the kettle, and then that'll be our total volume. And so that's a nice way, again, you know, you could do one of those sort of overnight mashes, or overnight boils, run off the next day, call your boil, and hey, there's your batch. Another approach we've taken, that could be a little finicky. If your volumes aren't right, you end up either dumping some first runnings or over, it can be a little sort of finicky to deal with. And so the other move we've done is, since we have a 10-barrel system and 20-barrel tanks, is we'll boil off from 13 barrels, which was what we could collect in our kettle, down to 7 barrels. The next day, add the hops, boil it for an hour, run that off, that first 7 barrels. That's the first third of the batch. And then we'll do that 2 more times. So we'll, again, fresh mash, collect 13 barrels, boil down to 7, run it off, collect 13 barrels, boil down to 7, run it off. And that's what I'm talking about, like those 170 beers. Those are the beers that we're finishing super high. And then those are great blending stock for the beers that finish at 1040 or 1050. Because once they're sort of in a barrel, I think you need to finish it, you know, at least 1050 or maybe even 1060 to really balance out a year or two in a barrel. And we've started playing around with like double barrel aging, where you age for a year in one barrel, rack it into a fresh barrel, a spirit barrel, age it for another year. Those sorts of things. Those beers really need a lot of sweetness to stand up to those sorts of levels of tannins.
Wow. So they're actually extracting that much tannin from the wood, I guess?
Yeah, it's a combination of the tannins, but also as empty as those barrels are, there's still a couple of gallons worth of spirit soaked into the wood. And mm-hmm. that's now been, you know, essentially tannin concentrate is really pulled out all that flavor. It's going to then thin out the beer, just because it is essentially distilled barrel-proof spirit that's raising the alcohol, but also thinning out the body. And so now all of a sudden, the beer that you put in that was 10% is maybe 11.5% or 12%.
Wow.
And so I think that's a piece of it too.
Well, what kind of ABVs are you shooting for here? You mentioned, so you're, say, 100 points is like a 12-13%, right?
Yeah, I'm personally wimpy when it comes to alcohol. I'm pretty happy if that beer is going into the barrel around 10%. I'm okay at 11 or 12. That's my sort of personal limit. And then if we get another 1.5 or 2% for the barrel, 13, 14, that's as much as I want. I know there are some great beers out there, and I've tasted some of them that, you know, are now pushing you know, probably 15 or 16 into the barrel, and then double barrel aging, 17, 18, 19% alcohol. To me, that's where you start just running into, unless you're someone who's accustomed to drinking spirits or fortified wines or something like that, they just tend to taste alcoholic. Not hot, not, you know, boozy, but just the alcohol becomes a really big flavor presence. And for me, that starts distracting from the roast, the grain, the wood, those things, and sends those beers more into a spiritous, you know, some, you know, if you've had Sam Adams Utopias or something like that, or, you know, something like a Madeira or a port or a sherry or something, it's a different balance, and alcohol really becomes a big flavor component. And so for me, you know, 10, 11, 12 into a barrel, great. A couple of my friends swear, you know, if you want to age a beer for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years in oak, like some of these breweries are doing now, that's where you really want to consider starting at a higher gravity and having more alcohol, because that's just going to help protect the beer. It's going to help it make it more resistant to oxidation, more resistant to you know, microbes, more resistant to sort of everything, and maybe be allowed to create more beneficial flavors as it ages.
Do you how do you ferment at these high gravities, and what kind of yeast do you use? That was another question I had.
Sure. We've used a whole bunch of different things. I'd honestly say that if you were trying to set up a program with blending, the more you could stick to one yeast strain, the better. The last thing you want is to have a more aggressive yeast strain in one batch and a less aggressive yeast strain in another batch. And then when you blend them together and bottle them or keg them, the more aggressive yeast starts going to work on the sugars from the other one. Honestly, US05 is pretty great. If you're shooting for, let's say, the low to mid end of that range, you know, 10, 11%, US05 does a great job. We don't tend to have American ale yeast around. We are sort of hazy IPAs, and most of our lower gravity stouts, we use English yeast. We have lager yeast around. We'll bring in Belgian yeast once in a while. And as a result, like a lot of those English strains are a little bit too wimpy for this. They'll peter out at 9.5 or so. There certainly are English yeast strains out there like Nottingham that can do a great job up to 13, 14%. But it's great just having dry yeast. We rehydrate it. So the way we do it is we collect a keg full of 180 degree water from our on-demand hot water heater. We cool it down. We add a rehydration yeast nutrient. So we use Startup, a GoFirm or something like that. It's the same product that has all the sterols and all the sort of nutrients that yeast needs. Rehydrate the yeast for half an hour, shake the keg up, and then we'll push that in line. While we're knocking out, we'll give it as much oxygen as it can during the entire knockout in line, and then we'll hit with more oxygen later in the tank.
I've used a double oxygen on really high gravity things like this, 12 hours or so.
And that's one of the great things about those multi-day brew days too, is that you hit it with more oxygen 24 hours in when you're adding your second dose of wort. So that can be a big help too.
Now, I just did an article on osmotic shock, which of course is, you know, a good reason to introduce the yeast to the real high gravity wort slowly. Do you actually do that or not?
We actually will do that on our sour beers more so when we're rehydrating yeast for pitching. We'll rehydrate them a little. What I'll sort of play around with is if we're doing one of these multi-brew knockouts into the same tank, I may not add much of my sugar to that first wort. So maybe my first knockout is 1-1-10, and then the second one is 1-1-70, something like that. So you're allowing that yeast to get going in a slightly lower gravity situation and then hitting it with the higher gravity wort. I know the brewers that do the really, again, the 20-21%, whatever, brews tend to hold back some of their sugar and add that a couple of days into fermentation.
I just introduce it slowly in the starter. So you start with the yeast starter, you introduce a little bit of must and or a little bit of wort, and then you do a little bit at a time, stepping up closer and closer to the starting gravity before you actually pitch, you know.
And so that's something we do on the sour side. We haven't found it to be necessary so far with the gravities we're dealing with, but certainly towards that top of the range, I'd say once you start going over 1140, 1150, that's where USO5 starts to have some trouble. I've talked to a couple other great brewers who do a blend of SO4 and SO5, more SO5 than SO4. SO4 can be a little too fruity for my tastes. We did an Imperial Stout early on that was all SO4. And I don't know if it's a stress fermentation, but it's just a very fruity, almost banana bread sort of flavor to it that I was not especially fond of. But we've done, say, 80% USO5, 20% SO4 that's done pretty well for us without being excessively fruity. When we have it on hand, I really love Irish ale yeast. Works great. It can be a little bit more attenuative. It seems to love dark beers. So like every year when we do our Irish dry stout, we bring in an Irish strain, I'll harvest that and pitch that into an Imperial Stout if I can. So there are a lot of great strains out there, and it really just comes down to, you know, what suits your fermentation temperatures. You know, obviously, like, take a look at the recommendations for the yeast lab on alcohol tolerance, things like that.
Every yeast strain has an alcohol tolerance, obviously, and the higher it is, the more fermentation you're going to get all the way out.
Yeah.
And the less.
And that's also obviously no guarantee you will get to that alcohol level. You know, if you don't have enough fermentable sugars, you'll stop before then. And if you really baby the yeast and do a great job, there's nothing to say it couldn't go a little bit past that number. But if you're trying to get to 13 or 14%, pick the one that says it's good to 14 or 15, not the one that says it's good to 9 or 10.
Yeah, I mean, I get into the 14-15%, you're really looking at more like wine yeast, honestly, in a lot of cases, champagne yeast, wine yeast, those kinds of things.
Yeah, and those can be really tough, though, because a lot of those strains aren't as attenuative as the other strains. So unless you're really feeding it just simple sugars or something at the end, a lot of the wine yeast will have trouble getting through all the maltotriose and the more complex sugars that a wort is likely to have.
Do you have other fermentation tips? Do you add nutrients during fermentation? We already talked about adding a second dose of oxygen, but...
No, we haven't found staggering nutrients. I know that's the Tonsa calculation stuff is big in mead and seltzers and things
Yeah, that's because the mead, the honey's nitrogen poor, really. And so doesn't have all the nutrients. Like maltose is almost perfect, obviously.
So. Exactly. And so we'll also use, rather than like table sugar, we'll use, they're called brewer's crystals. It's essentially just a mix of maltose and maltodextrin that's derived from corn. And that's another, like, we'll use that in our IPAs and double IPAs and triple IPAs because it's more flavor neutral. But I think malt extract does a pretty good job. And again, yeah, it has maybe not as much nutrient as a all malt work, but we're adding a lot of malt. I would just in general be cautious of using like Marist Otter and some of those malts just aren't. Don't necessarily have the enzymatic oomph to convert a wort that size with a whole lot of, you know, flaked oats or a whole lot of caramel malt or a whole lot of roasted malt. We use a lot of the Breese Pale Ale malt. It's probably not quite as characterful and not quite as bready, malty, rounded as a Maris Otter or a Chevalier or something. But we also haven't had the stalled fermentations that we had a couple of times with heavily English pale ale, heritage, whatever malts. But honestly, otherwise for fermentation, I'd start it towards the cold end of the fermentation. You're going to be having so much fermentation that you really want to restrain esters and fusels and all those things as much as possible. You might consider adding some zinc to your wort. We add cervomyces, which is White Lab sells it. It's a yeast that's been saturated with zinc. I really don't know that it's that much better than like zinc heptahydrate or something like that. But a lot of people say that sort of zinc is the one nutrient that all malt wort doesn't have, yeast really need. Again, I never used it at home, rarely used it at home without issue. But on this scale, like $3 worth of insurance for a 600-gallon batch really feels worthwhile. And then, yeah, it just, a good healthy fermentation shouldn't take much longer than a week. If you're really seeing that yeast just barely, maybe dropping only a point a day for a week or two at the end, it's probably a sign that it wasn't the healthiest fermentation in the world. You really want to see a good healthy fermentation for about a week. It gets the gravity, maybe you have 1 or 2 days where it just creeps down a little bit and then you're done. Once you start dealing with the really high starting gravities, in addition to aerating partway through, you might consider rousing, like either giving a little shake to your carboy or your fermenter. If it's a conical, bubbling a little CO2 from the bottom just to knock out that residual CO2 that's stuck in the beer.
Yeah, it creates carbonic acid in the beer, which can inhibit fermentation over the long term. That's one of the reasons they roused a lot of wines and meads and ciders for that reason.
Yeah, and particularly with these really high stirring gravities, the viscosity of it, just the bubbles of CO2, you can see when you pull a sample of it, the bubbles just very slowly rise to the surface. And again, at our scale, a 20-barrel tank isn't exactly that big of a tank. It's amazing how vigorously it will bubble after just a very short blast of CO2 from the bottom. It really is shocking how much CO2 is trapped in there.
And yeah, again, if you're at home, you got to be careful because it'll go right over the top of your fermenter.
and that honestly is probably a good advice. This is a good one too. If you've got, like, as a home brewer, I used to use those. I think you were probably close to 9-gallon fermenters for my 5-gallon batches, just so I wouldn't have to worry about an airlock clogging or making a mess with a blow off tube or whatever. So, good one to do. In an oversized fermenter, if you've got one available.
Yeah, especially these big beers. So you're finishing in a week or so. I assume it's still got to age for quite some time, though, even before you want to serve it on tap, right?
Oh, yeah, no. And so that's sort of the biggest thing at that point is get it fermented out. I know there are some brewers that, swear by conditioning it, 50 or 60 or whatever. We pretty quickly get down to as cold as we can get it. We'll crash down to about 30 degrees. We'll drop out yeast for a few days, then we'll add biofine. So salicylic acid, finding agent, you could add gelatin, you could add anything else. Because that beer still has so much sugar in it, yeast just doesn't want to drop out nearly as well as it does in other beers. And I sort of like if you go to the Dead Sea, you float. It's kind of like the yeast cells are not dropping as quickly because the density is 1050 rather than 005 or whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. So it takes quite a while.
And not only that, but stouts, there's always going to be this very fine roasted bits that got through the lautering. they don't want to drop out, and they really can make your beer harsh, sharp, unpleasant. And what you really want is to get all of that out. If you have, you know, obviously if you're a commercial brewer with a filter or a centrifuge or something like that, that's great. But at our scale and for most home brewers, sort of time, you know, at least a week, if not 2 weeks cold, getting as much of that yeast as you can is really important.
Now, how quick can you take one of these, say, medium-sized ones and get it onto the tap?
So it really depends. Usually about a month is sort of our sort of standard thing.
That's pretty quick, really.
About a week of fermentation, a week and a half, say, of clarification, and then a few days infusing if we're doing adjuncts or something like that, and then a few days, you know, carbonate it, let it sit, you know, get it into a keg, give it a couple of days in a keg or a can to settle out. And again, it's particularly if you're doing adjuncts, I mean, that sort of then becomes the star of the show. And people really, just like a dry hopped beer, if you're putting all this time and effort into getting coconut or coffee or chocolate aromatics, people really want to taste that as bright and fresh and intense as they can. So we sort of clarify it. We add those ingredients pretty late, and then we get it on tap. And then sort of the same approach with the barrels. We'll put it into barrels first, and then we're adding all those ingredients after it was in the barrel. So right
before very end, yeah.
I get one of my good buddies at Jailbreak Brewing near us, they add coconut to a batch before barrels, and he said it like really turned into this fantastically marshmallowy, super interesting beer. So I'm not saying that you can't add these ingredients first. And I used to work for the guys at Bottle Logic, one of their things was adding vanilla beans to the barrel when aging, just because vanilla takes a long time to really extract out. And so there's definitely things you can play around with. But in general, I adjunct late. I would rather give myself the option to taste the barrels and then add the adjuncts that suit it rather than adding them early and sort of committing to that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, most of the stout, as you mentioned, does end up in barrels for an extended period. What tips do you have for barrel aging?
Sure. We are fanatical when it comes to oxygen pickup. That's sort of the thing that we do, I think, just as well as anybody, is keep oxygen out of the beer. So that's the most important thing when you're aging a beer, is to give it the best chance to be as fresh as possible when somebody goes to drink it. And you're starting at a disadvantage with a barrel because wood is porous. You're transferring the beer into multiple vessels. Evaporation happens, then you have headspace. The staves at the top can dry out, oxygen can get in. And so we just do everything we can. So we'll purge each barrel with CO2 before filling. We'll put a little bead of food grade silicon caulk around the edge of the barrel just to make sure that's sort of where it leaks. On the top of the head is sort of the most common place for leaks. So we'll put a little silicon caulking there. We will purge our barrel filling tool between each barrel fill just to make sure that the sort of the racking cane piece of it doesn't have any air in it. So we've got sort of a whole setup, and I there's pictures on my blog, I'm sure, of sort of the setup we use. And we do that for sour beers or clean beers. We try to get barrels that are as fresh as possible. The big thing right now, I think so many people who were sort of the earlier wave of craft beer drinkers, you know, probably I just turned 40 last year. We're all drinking bourbon now, not me, but everybody else, all my friends seem to be drinking bourbon. And so it seems like what people really want now is they don't just want to say bourbon barrel aged. They want a Weller barrel aged. They want a Heaven Hill 12 year. They know about the bourbon. And so they want to be able to connect those two things that they love. They want to be able to connect the Imperial Stout that they love with the bourbon they love. And so being able to tell them it's this particular barrel. And as a home brewer, the great thing you can do is if you want to, you can just, I mean, it's getting harder and harder to buy good bourbon. You can, whether it's just adding bourbon directly to a barrel, to a beer, or soaking chips in the bourbon of your choice.
Yeah, we can. I mean, you can blend bourbon in, right? Or we can, I should say. You can't do it commercially, but.
Exactly. Really, in a lot of ways, barrel aging is sort of the legal workaround to what would be the more fun thing, which would just be to add bourbon to taste. And wood to taste. And honestly, there's some great breweries. Revolution in Chicago does some of the best barrel aged stouts in the world, and they've talked recently about they barrel age, but then at the end they'll maybe add some wood directly to the beer just to get that wood flavor where they want it. So again, the more levers you can pull, the better. There are a lot of great barrel brokers who deal in smaller barrels, and there's no reason not to get a little 5 gallon or 10 gallon barrel if that's what interests you. As a general rule of thumb, every time you go up an order of magnitude, so 10 times, you're halving the amount of wood contact. So from a 5 gallon barrel to sort of a standard 50 gallon bourbon barrel, you're getting twice as much wood in the 5 gallon barrel as you do in the 50.
So it doesn't take as long, I would assume, right?
Exactly. And usually the staves are smaller or sort of thinner, so you may get more oxygen contact. You'll probably get more evaporation. So, you know, again, think about, you know, tasting that beer, you know, relatively frequently. You know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks even can be enough in a little small barrel. When I dealt with little barrels at home, I'd always sort of stagger having another beer ready to go into that barrel when the first one came out. So maybe an Imperial Stout to start, maybe a barley wine after that, and then maybe a sour beer or something lighter, easier drinking. You'll get character from the previous beer as well. And so that barley wine may end up being a little bit more roasty, chocolatey, whatever, if you allow it to go right in after the stout, versus, say, rinsing out the barrel, throwing some bourbon in there, turning it around, dumping it out. For us, it generally just isn't worth refilling barrels on the non-sour side. So sometimes we'll retire them to the sour side. But generally, if we're going through the effort of barrel aging, it's for $200 I can get a new barrel. That's going to be a lot more valuable than just refilling an old barrel, unless there's something really special about it, unless I'm really looking for that influence of the previous beer on the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I did want to mention oxygen one more time. I know you work really hard to keep oxygen out, but oxygen actually is important for a really long-aged beer because it gives you some of those kind of warm, sherry-like flavors, especially in a stout, right?
Oh, definitely. And I guess I should say that I would rather, all things being equal, having to age my beer longer to get those flavors, but also get more wood flavor, more evaporation, all those things, rather than just sort of the splashing early on that maybe is going to lead to more. People talk about micro-oxidation versus macro-oxidation, those sorts of things. That's sort of that slow control, too, because that can go too far into soy sauce, into, you know, you can start freeing up acetaldehyde and diacetyl and those sorts of things. So I'd rather it be very light. And then as I pull a sample a year in, go, okay, this could go another couple of months, and pull another one. Okay, this is getting close. Now let me make a plan on blending rather than 6 months in being already, you know, over that hill into papery or cardboard or something like that. So,
yeah, yeah.
Everyone has their own preferences for things, and I've always just been a let's say a aggressive keeping oxygen out, and then there's always going to be some barrels that leak a little bit more than you expect, or that, yeah, you know, the staves weren't quite as tight as they should have been, and one's always going to be a little oxidized, and hey, that might be a great centerpiece for a blend. Whereas the one that's cleaner and brighter and fresher, more vanilla and chocolate, maybe is going to work more with the coconut and coffee or whatever it is.
Now, obviously all homebrewers can't barrel age. Some people don't have the space. Some people don't have the time. What are some good alternatives using chips, spirals? We already discussed spirits, for example.
Yeah. I always really like the more substantive pieces of woods rather than anything that's really fine, that's going to extract super fast, whether it's cubes or spirals or staves. Something that's got, you know, a quarter inch, a half inch of wood, that's really, to me, where those sort of more interesting flavors tend to be, is that it's, as the beer penetrates into the wood, it's going to go through different levels of char and toast and wood and pull out sort of a bigger variety of flavors rather than a really thin piece of wood, a chip or a sawdust or something. It's just going to be woody and sort of extract its maximum amount in 3 or 4 weeks. Where you're really looking for something that you'll sort of slowly, it'll keep getting a little bit more oaky, a little bit more woody. Personally, I don't think that there's much benefit in soaking the oak in something and then adding it to the beer.
Yeah, I've heard people
do that. I really would just rather add the wood, and then if you want to add a bottle of red wine, a fifth of bourbon, some port, and then you can just put that into taste. I think that, to me, makes a lot more sense. The soaking thing is really, maybe it mimics a little bit better the barrel character, but really sort of the magic of the barrel is that the spirits or the wine or where they're in the wood have already partially evaporated and they've concentrated, and just soaking in a closed jar, you know, a cup of wood cubes in bourbon for 2 weeks, I don't think particularly well mimics the what's happening in a barrel that's 12 years old, or we've gotten some there, you know, 20 years old and we're half empty and those sorts of things. I personally stay away from, you know, they sell like rum flavorings and things like that for distilling. I generally don't think that those things taste particularly like the real spirits.
And so I
wouldn't bother with those. And sometimes there are like some fun, you know, like every once in a while you hear, I can't remember, there's like some mushroom that tastes like cognac or something. And those, sort of weird things like that could be fun or unique, but probably not going to mimic the real flavor of the spirit as well as the real spirit, which you're allowed to add.
Sure, sure. Well, you do often add flavorings, right? Spices, cocoa nibs, vanilla. Which ones have you found work best? And I'm assuming you're adding these to taste at the end, right?
Yeah, so we for a long time we would just use sort of a Brinks. So essentially a 15-gallon keg that has a 4-inch opening at the top. We'd stuff whatever we wanted in there, put the lid on, perch it with CO2, fill it with beer, let it sit for a day or two, push it back in the tank, taste the tank. If it had enough flavor, we're done. If not, refill. If one or two more of those sort of refills doesn't work, then maybe we'll get some more of whatever that ingredient was. Now we have it's about 100-gallon tank, so we can put even more stuff in there. so for something like coffee beans, like it just doesn't take that much coffee. We'll use for a 200-gallon batch, 20 or 30 pounds of coffee, so we can fit that into a relatively small thing.
Sure.
Something like coconut, though, we might be using 200 pounds of coconut, you know, close to 1 pound of coconut per gallon. And then, honestly, a lot of that stuff, it's kind of like cooking. Me saying use coconut is, like, not any of the secret. The secret is, like, we really love, like, nuts.com has a sweetened toasted coconut that we think is really awesome. When it comes to coffee, we really love working with a local roaster, Vigilante, in Hyattsville, Maryland. They'll roast for us the day that we're adding the coffee to the beer. We've found that when you add coffee that's even, say, a week old, we often get this sort of like green jalapeno, peppery sort of flavor from very low level oxidation in that coffee. And so for us, even though coffee, maybe you're not supposed to brew with it if it's only been roasted 4 hours ago, we've found that making beer with it, that's sort of the ideal time to do it. Vanilla beans have gotten a lot less expensive. When we first started doing this, even sort of mediocre Madagascar vanilla beans were $200 a pound, $250 a pound. And now there's been a couple of wholesalers who have come in, particularly Jones & Co., which is also Vanillas of the World. And they have all these amazing vanilla beans from all sorts of different places. And each one has different flavor descriptors. We had these amazing Tonga vanilla beans that just tastes like marshmallow fluff and dried fruit and all these fantastic things. I think vanilla is super magical. I think coffee is great. With coffee, I would go for I tend to like lighter roasts because I think I'm already getting enough roast in the beer from the roasted malts, the grains, all that kind of thing.
There's a lot of tannins in there.
Yeah. I love nuts. We do walnuts. We do toasted almonds. We do macadamia. We do hazelnut. And again, like I toast them myself at home in my oven, you know, when it's more than about 100 pounds, we visit one of our friends who has a industrial kitchen at their brewery and use that because they've got like a seven shelf convection oven. But like high quality, fresh nuts that are toasted until they're golden brown, add amazing real flavors. once in a while, I'm forced to add, you know, hazelnut extract or something like that. But whenever I can, I like using the real stuff. Maple syrup is another one that's very difficult to make a maple beer that's as maple-y as a lot of the maple beers out there. And almost all of them are using some sort of maple extract, maple flavoring. Maple syrup just is, even the dark stuff. And we did a batch that was 10% maple syrup by volume. So wow. It was in 600 gallons of beer, 60 gallons of it was maple syrup. And it was noticeably maple-y, but not nearly as maple-y as some other maple stouts I've had from great breweries that I respect. Maple extract is one of those that I think a lot of people fall back to because it's so much less expensive than real maple syrup. And honestly, it gives people really, when they think maple syrup, they think of, Log Cabin or something like that. They're not thinking of Sugar Shack maple from Quebec or Vermont.
Yeah.
So vanilla, chocolate, coffee, coconut. Honestly, any of those ingredients, coconut, nuts, really add mouthfeel, body, richness. I don't know if that's the proteins or the oils, but they really can balance out beer or stouts. They're a little too roasty. They're a little too thin, and give them a more luscious mouthfeel, for lack of better phrasing.
Well, we're running a little bit low on time, but I want to ask about blending. Do you blend the finished beers? How do you decide what to blend? How do you pick the strengths and the weaknesses out?
Sure. So sometimes I sort of plan things out. So the stout I'm drinking right now, Songs for Spiders, was beers were in the same. So we were getting two of these fun barrels that were I.W. Harper, which is a bourbon that's then finished in red wine barrels. They're like really high end red wine barrels from Silver Oak, I think. Silver something. I don't know much about wine. And so I intentionally picked one beer that we had that was super duper sweet. Second barrel, so it had already been in one barrel, went into these barrels, and it was finished at 1/100, sticky sweet, caramel, not much roast. And then we'd done a Scottish Imperial Stout. So something based on a wee heavy, but with more roasted barley, that finished at more like 1040. And so that was like something I planned for. Most of the time, though, we're just going through the cellar, tasting things. Hey, we said we were going to do chocolate and vanilla on a beer. Let's taste and find some barrels that have chocolate and vanilla notes already that we think we could enhance. And let's also be thinking about how sweet they are. Will these pair together? Is there a story I can tell with the barrels? Are these from the same manufacturer or the same distillery that would make it easier to say, hey, this beer is these two barrels that really fit together and are pushing the same flavors? Or are we balancing two flavors against each other? Like a lot of things, it just takes time and practice and making sure that you are tasting the beer itself as you're blending it, hopefully with some friends. But then also that you're, taking some time to sit around and drink good barrel-aged stouts or whatever you're thinking of blending to kind of get a feel for what you like, what the beers that are out there, what kind of balance they have. Do you like that balance? Do you not like that balance? Are they too sweet? Are they not sweet enough? What do you like a sip of but sort of figure out that you get bored of after some time? So much of blending is just setting up that you have a variety of things aging, that you have some things that are sweeter, some things that are drier, some things that are roastier. For one of our sort of big releases every year, BSCV, Bourbon, Stout, Coconut, Vanilla, it's usually a 4-oak barrel blend, and usually one of those barrels is barley wine. And for that one, we're sort of pushing coconut and vanilla really hard, and I want to back the roast down a little bit. And so having a sweeter, caramelly barley wine sort of mellows out the roast on the other barrels, adds some body, adds some complexity, and allows that vanilla and coconut to really sing rather than having to fight through as much chocolate roast toast as it might otherwise.
Do you have any thoughts on finishing and packaging? We just got a minute or two here.
Sure. We force carbonate. We don't bottle condition. You certainly could, but these beers are so tough to deal with, and just getting them to ferment is so tough. starting up fermentation again can be a real challenge.
Yeah.
We aim for low carbonation, 2.2, 2.3 volumes of CO2. Obviously, you could just keg it, serve it like that. But these are beers that, you know, you may not want to have a whole keg on draft for a while. And having a cellar is a great option. You could even consider something, and again, sort of go in the mead world, the wine world, a little metabisulfite, a little potassium sorbate if you're worried about re-fermentation. There's a lot of options out there to sort of make a beer that is going to be stable, even if you don't have pristine equipment.
Yeah, the two of those, a combination of those two will obviously inhibit fermentation. So,
And sulfite's a great antioxidant as well. So that's another good advantage of that.
It absolutely is. Yeah, that's why they use a lot of it in wines, for example.
If you can't purge your bottles with CO2 or whatever.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I want to get your closing thoughts on these big, giant barrel-aged stouts.
Honestly, it's not the kind of thing I drink all the time, but they're a really fun beer to share with people. They're the kind of beer that a lot of people who aren't into beer don't think they're into beer. You give them something that tastes like a toasty, chocolatey milkshake. They're going to love it. And that really spans. And there are friends, fathers who, you know, the only beers they drink are bourbon barrel imperial stouts. And some of my mother's favorite beers are imperial stouts. Her biggest complaint is just that they're not carbonated enough. She would love a seltzer carbonated imperial stout, and someday I'll make one.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure, Brad. Hopefully we get to do this again in a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to make the trip out to Columbia. I got to have some of this stout stuff. That'll make me go out there.
You might want to get there's a good hotel around the corner if you're going to have a couple of them.
My guest today is Michael Tonsmeyer. He's author of the book American Sour Beers and award-winning founder at Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland. Thank you again, Michael.
Cheers.
Cheers. A big thank you to Michael Tonsmeyer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They've recently launched an all-new experience, Craft Spirits and Distilling. If you make or love spirits, check out spiritsanddistilling.com for recipes, how-to videos, their Spirits and Distilling podcast, and much more. Again, that new site is spiritsanddistilling.com. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith for the Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, reminder, click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support our show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.